Okay, so when this is getting started, what I want to do today is to tell you about my talk is going to be in two parts. In the first part, I'm going to discuss what I was assigned to discuss, I guess, about what we've learned about wnt morphogens and the. In particular, I'm going to talk about what we think the proteoglycans and the way they interact with wingless in terms of forming this protein gradient. And the function of the Friesold transducing receptor. So that's going to be the first part of my talk. And in the second part, I seem to be some. Okay, this is not working. Let me just figure that out. Do I have to readjust? This may be. Let's see. Probably have to go to the modem, right? Monitor. Orange. Ah, well done. There we go. I don't know what he did here, I'm not sure. Well, that's what's great about PowerPoint, you know. I'm not sure they used to do it in the olden days because I basically reformatted my talk.
I know exactly what to do.
Let's see if this is working.
I've got exactly the same program.
Is it going?
Same
stuff. Ah, there it goes. Okay, and in the second part of my talk, I'm going to discuss some screens that we're doing or some methodology we've developed on using RNAi as a screening method in terms of trying to basically get to the issue of networks and modules and so on. So, here we go. So first, I'll start by answering the question which was asked this morning, that what would I ask the good fairy? And I think the real issue that as we're pushing the use of genetics to understand complex system is whether or not the conclusion that we draw from the genetic approaches that we were taking really is an accurate reflection of the process that we're studying. And in the context of the osmorphogen gradients, I think we have to realize that basically when we do a genetic experiment, either whether or not it's a loss of function, gain of function, or overexpression, or dominant negative, and so on, we're basically looking at the response of the system to the injury that we've made, basically using the genetic tool. So we've really got to be careful about, I think, the overall information that we're extracting. And in the context of the morphogen gradients, we usually try to follow the morphogens by either looking at different aspects of protein trafficking. And the real issue here is whether or not we don't really know in many cases what where the real activity is. And to actually illustrate those kind of worries on a more cartoonish aspect, I basically took this. This picture here from which basically is a projection of the myth of the cave from Plato, where if you look at the image here, you think that you might be studying looking at students in a classroom, but in fact, it may be the reflection of another kind of scene, which may lead you actually to the wrong conclusion if you are using this as the accurate image of reality. So I think in the case of morphogen gradients, eventually, I'd like to really visualize the morphogen protein gradient, also be able to visualize the overall graded signaling activity that is derived from the activation of the receptor which receive this information. And also, you'd like to make sure that there is a graded transcriptional response which is triggered by this morphogen gradient. And experimentally, you'd like to basically be able to demonstrate that the graded transcriptional response and the various set effects that you get really read this level of morphogens. Okay, so those were as a general introduction, and I said I'm going to discuss mostly the drosophila wingless, and just since maybe not all of you are familiar with wingless, just have a few facts here about drosophila wingless. So wingless is a member of the wing family, which are basically glycoproteins, proteins which are modified by sugars, and that basically form morphogenic ingredients in a number of different developmental processes. And those wing proteins bind the glycosaminoglycan in the extracellular matrix, and I'll be talking about those glycosaminoglycan, which are basically proteins which are modified by long chains of sugars. And at least in flies, I mean, wingless has been implicated in many developmental processes. And the one that I'll be discussing is the role of the function of wingless in patterning the imaginal disc. And in the wing imaginal disc, those wingless act both as the short range and long range inducer. And so the system we'll be looking at is the wing blade, the wing imaginal disc. And the wingless is expressed in a stripe in about three rows of cells in the dorsoventral boundary, which is going to correspond to this position here on the overall wing. And wingless moves from the DV border and organize and regulate the expression of genes in this wing blade here. And the idea is that there is a gradient basically that emanates then from the dorsoventral boundary and generate a gradient of wingless protein, which just goes on and activate again genes which have different responsive ability to either high level of wingless or low level of wingless.
What is defining that?
Oh, there are just a set of genes which are expressed early on. It's a little bit like in the embryo where you see those genes coming up in stripes and so on. So there is a set of transcriptional activator which define the position of this wingless stripe. So these are basically two of the different markers we are looking at. This wingless is shown here at the DV border in green, in both. And you have the response here of a short orange target gene, senseless, which is in red, which you can see only is expressed in the two or three cells away from the DV border. And here you have another gene, distalless, which is responding in about 30 or 50 cells away from the margin. So there are a couple of mechanisms which have been proposed for this wingless morphogen movement. That's also true for some of the other morphogens that we'll be hearing later. But basically, the first model is a simple diffusion model where wingless goes out of the cell and either through passive or restricted diffusion is able to move extracellularly and then interact with its transducing receptor and get internalized and activate the signaling pathways. And the difference between passive and restrictive is that in the context of restricted would be additional factors like perhaps, as I'm going to make the point, maybe proteoglycans, which are regulating this planar distribution, extracellular distribution of the morphogen. And then there are additional models which have been proposed, which are where there is, rather than having an extracellular diffusion, the wingless morphogen may be moving from cells to cells through some kind of transcytotic or vesicular system, which would be acting from, which would be again transferring the morphogen from cells to cells. So I should say right now that the model that we favor is this restricted diffusion model. And hopefully this is going to become clear from the kind of information data that I'm going to present. But first, if you just do staining from the, if you just look at what the distribution of wingless is in the imaginal disc, you basically get different views of where the wingless protein is, depending on what kind of staining protocol you use. And this is really, I think, sort of illustrate a little bit the point I was trying to make in terms of trying to really try to determine which one is the important pool of wingless protein that we should be paying attention to in those staining experiments. So there is a protocol where you can actually, which was developed by Strigini and Cohen, where you basically incubate the imaginal disc with the antibody against wingless, and then you do the fixation, and then you see where the protein is, the antibody is recognizing the protein. When you do this, you see that mostly wing glass is found extracellularly. You do see actually a little punctate staining as well. But now if you do a fixation and then you incubate the disc into the antibody, you mostly see, well, you see a lot of wing glass coming from the stripe, and the, but then most of the wing glass outside the stripe is actually found in those punctates.
Is this apical, basal, or all over?
The staining of wing glass is mostly basolateral in those discs. Yeah.
And it's a single cell
thick. Yeah, you can assume that it's at this stage. Yes, it's a single layer.
And does wing glass go all the way from? How far does it go?
Well, it really depends on what you're looking at again, because if you're looking at the extracellular staining, it's sort of it's strong near the border, but then it fades away, so it's not clear whether it's a question of sensitivity. We may not be able to detect this this wing glass like more than 10, 15 cells away.
In but the disc itself is much bigger.
It's about like, yeah, let's say 50 cells on each side, yeah. So we can only detect it up to a certain point. But on the other hand, you do have other ways to other. If you look at some of the transcriptional targets, you can see them. You can see a response which is wingless dependent, quite far away. So what I want to talk about then is mostly the function of the proteins that are receiving the wingless, which are seeing wingless at the cell surface, and mostly going to be talking about two different groups of protein. Those proteoglycan, which are heparan sulfate proteoglycan of the glypican family. So it's mostly a protein core which is attached to the membrane through a GPI link. And those glypican molecules are decorated with a few chains of glycosaminoglycans, which are sugar chains. And the protein core is called DALI or DALI-like. And this, again, there is a small number of chains which are glycosaminoglycan chains which are attached to those. And then I'll be talking about what is believed to be the transducing receptors for wingless, and there are two different cement transmembrane proteins called Frizzled and Frizzled 2, and those again are supposed to be the one that transmit the signal to the cytoplasm. So first, let's show you what we think those glypicans are doing. And so this is the structure of those glypican molecules, where you have the protein core here in purple, and those protein core, they go through the ER and Golgi, are being decorated by those glycosaminoglycan chains, and there is a pretty complex set of enzymes which are acting together to synthesize this glycosaminoglycan. But at the end of the day, you end up with a series of sugars, which is a glucake, a glucuronic acid, and then acetylglucosamine. So it's a glucake, glucnac, and so on. And those sugar bonds the sugars are then subsequently modified by a number of different enzymes, mostly sulfotransferase, which are going to modify the original structure of the glycosaminoglycan. And through those modifications are going to confer different specificity, presumably to the glycosaminoglycan chain. And so from the way we became interested in those glycosaminoglycan and proteoglycans is through the identification of a number of different genes which ended up to encode the enzymes involved in the synthesis of that sugar. And I'm not really going to get into a lot of the genetics here, but one of the issues that we have in trying to study the function of those proteoglycans is that many of the enzymes are it's not like if you're studying, for example, the RAS-RAF pathway, where you have if you look at the phenotype of RAF or the downstream targets, MEK, and so on, you get identical phenotypes. There seem to be a lot of when you start to look at the phenotype of one of those enzymes, you end up with a different product, basically a different type of glycosaminoglycan chain. And when we're trying to infer a function of the final product based on the analysis of those enzyme phenotypes, it can get very tricky because we don't. Since we are dealing with a new product which is going to decorate the cell surface, we're not quite sure exactly that we are extrapolating it to the real function of the wild type glycosaminoglycan. But regardless, we can maybe go back to this later on, but most of what the analysis that we've done is on this sulfateless enzyme, which we believe is really getting us as close to the null phenotype as we can get from the for a loss of glycosaminoglycan chains at the cell surface. So if we look now at the phenotype of mutations that presumably remove the glycosaminoglycan function of the apparent sulfate in the imaginal disk, what we basically see, and this is so this is a wild-type imaginal disk, and you know, what we've done is to look at the mosaic imaginal disk where three-quarter of it is mutant for sulfateless, and the remaining is wild-type. What we basically see is that first, there is no effect on the transcription of wingless. But now when we do different stainings, either for mostly cytoplasmic wingless or extracellular wingless, we see that there is, we see no, or very few dots, or no dots outside the wingless expressing domain. And we get very little extracellular wingless, okay? So based on this, we conclude that the apparent sulfate proteoglycans are required for the wingless retention on the cell surface, as well as the movement of wingless, if we consider those dots to reflect the movement of wingless from the secreting cells. What we can also see now is that if we make different kind of mosaics and we look at the retention of wingless at cell surface, we find that you basically need the proteoglycans, so those are wild-type cells, to trap wingless. This actually did not really reproduce very well, but another example here where you can see in the imaginal. This is a sulfateless mutant, which would be the apparent sulfate glycosaminoglycan null. So this is basically what would happen, presumably, yeah. And we can see that basically only when you have wild-type cells, you can see those dots, which represent presumably the internalized wingless from which would require this apparent sulfate proteoglycan. So I've told you about the mutations that affect the enzymes, but again, I wanted to make the point, and this is something we've been struggling with for the past a few years, which is that we want to be very careful that when we see a phenotype, when a specific phenotype, and based on those mutations that affect the enzyme, we want to make sure that we also are able to come up with the same conclusion when we look at different enzymes or different modifications. So when we look now at when we modulate the activity of those glypicans, we can also start to look at what happened to the retention of wingless.
Do you understand why the proteoglycans are needed for the receptor? Because receptors are really proteoglycans. What is the communication between them?
Right, so maybe I should get back to this. Let me talk about the receptor after. The bottom line, we're not sure that say in the case of FGF, for example, I don't know if you're familiar with this literature, but the proteoglycan would be required as well for presenting the ligand to the transducing receptor. In our case, we basically have no idea that this would be what the proteoglycan is really doing. It may simply just accumulate wingless to the cell surface and provide some kind of local environment, increase maybe the local concentration of wingless and at the cell surface, and then through maybe dissociation from the proteoglycan lead to the activation of the transducing receptor. The thing you have to realize is that those proteoglycans, the affinity of wingless to proteoglycan is supposed to be an order of magnitude less than or many orders than the affinity of the ligand for the transducing receptor. So those are considered to be low affinity receptors in contrast to the Friesold transducing receptors. But the point of this slide here is simply to show that most of the work that we've done is on this DALI-like glypican. We think this is the main component for wingless signaling. And kind of images here, just simply to show that we can demonstrate co-immunolocalization between wingless and DALI-like glypican, which is consistent with this notion that this glypican is critical to wingless signaling. And we've done mis-expression experiments where now we overexpress the DALI-like, and we can We can demonstrate that if we increase the level of the glypican Dali-like at the cell surface, we can really get a very efficient trapping of wingless at the cell surface. And this trapping of wingless is associated with a loss of function wingless signaling. And we basically believe that when we wingless is associated with a proteoglycan, basically if we change the relative level of glypican versus transducing receptor, for example, we now can block the access of the Friesel to wingless, and this is something we can very easily demonstrate by looking at the target genes. And here you can see, for example, that if we overexpress Dali-like in this domain, you basically lose the expression of the target genes, primary target gene like Senseless. So basically, increasing the level of Dali-like is like a loss of function wingless signaling, presumably because we get, as shown here, trapping the extracellular space of wingless.
When you have a short range effect, I guess it's
Senseless, yeah.
Senseless gene, it's still the same signaling and the same receptor that's involved, or is there some other mechanism? So for example, is it just some high threshold to wingless that's generating the short range response, or do you really mean that short range response is something, some other mechanism?
Oh, well, the way we interpret this is that simply that we deplete, we prevent the recognition, the access, we prevent the access of wingless to Friesel to the transducing receptor. Is that because this is not just for this short range? That's probably what you want. Oh, I deleted the slide. But basically, if we look at a long range target as well, we lose as well the response. So it's really we're trapping. If you make too much proteoglycan, you just trap wingless and you cannot access. Right? So this is really a summary of what I've been telling you so far. That that either through the experiments on sulfatless or Dali-like, we basically show that you need those proteoglycan for this planar movement of wingless, and we believe that again this is all happening in the extracellular space. And we believe that sulfatless, those activity are required in the receiving cells for the binding of wingless to the cells. And again, as I just mentioned,
it's almost a contradiction, 1 and 3, isn't it? On the one hand, it's necessary for the movement.
Well, I think this is.
On the other hand, it traps it. Are you going to explain that?
Well, I think it's all respective to the level and the fact that. So we think it's going on since those proteoglycans are low affinity. Receptor, that there is a kinetic of association and dissociation, and so some wingless, because wingless is coming as
to prevent it wandering off.
Yes.
The medium.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So if you make a grain of wingless in at the source, and you make like a boundary by putting a high level of this gene, will it block the grain of after?
Yeah. I. Well. The answer is yes. We can see those shadows. We just don't have the perfect. We haven't made the perfect line as the way you would like to see it, I guess. And we know that those things are able to move a little bit on the size. But the answer is yes. Yeah. Yeah. No. This. Oh, this. This is a little distortion of, yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure exactly what. This is, in this case, we may just have enough wingless coming out from the outside, yeah, which is sneaking on. That's the point I was trying to. Yeah.
Do I have it right that the lumen of the wing disk is a great ocean?
Which is a little bit the idea that we have, that those proteoglycans are sort of making a local environment to prevent this loss of wingless in the extracellular space. Yeah.
But there really is a big volume.
There is a volume. Yeah. People have seen actually other morphogens like DPP floating in this thing. Right?
Is there a basement under the baseline of these cells?
Well, there is a basement membrane, but yeah. This is. Yeah, I'm not sure this is really. Yeah. But it's on the other side. The basement membrane is on the other side of this lumen, right? Yeah. Okay, so the conclusion then, I think we think that those proteoglycans are really involved in this movement, planar movement of windlass. And again, one of the points that we can make is that the respective level of the HSPG versus presumably the Friesold transducing receptor is really critical for the to lead to the proper activation and the proper response and activation of the graded activity of the Friesold transmembrane receptors. So let me now tell you a little bit about the Friesold receptors. And one of the first experiments we've done is to generate clones of cells who are basically in the imaginal disk where we are removing the Friesold, both the Friesold 1 and the Friesold 2 receptor. And so what we see, we basically have detect two responses. The first one is actually not probably not that important for this audience here, but basically we see a local increase in the domain of windlass expression because there is a windlass self-refinement process which is involved at the margin. So that's why we see an enlarged margin, which is actually telling us that there is no windlass signaling happening because windlass signaling is required for local sharpening of the windlass expression domain. But the thing that we do notice that there is actually still some of those little dots that we detect before, and which would suggest that, which is telling us basically that the activity of the Friesold 2 receptor, the signaling activity is not required for this movement, or at least the generation of those dots. And that presumably there is still a little controversy in terms of, because we one of the alleles still make a little bit of Friesold extracellular domain, but it's possible as well that the receptors themselves are not required for this presumably endocytosis of windlass protein. Yeah. Yeah, if we have no like, that's what it would look like. Yeah, and presumably the proteoglycan might be what's involved in the endocytosis, because we see no dots in the loss of when we remove the proteoglycan. But the system is more complex because there are additional receptors like there is another Friesold, the Friesold 3, which is also expressed in disk, which can touch windlass presumably, and there are other receptors like Arrow, which are also involved. And that really gets down to the complexity of studying those systems in those complex tissues. That there are many, many proteins which that we know about, and perhaps others that we don't really know about, which might be involved in this overall regulation.
But this one suggests that when you look at the
that's right. If you look, that's right. So if you remove Shibiri, you have no dots. But what I'm showing you here is that if you remove Friesold and Friesold 2, you see dots. And Eric actually just saw that the same in the embryo a few years ago. So there is something else, but the caveat here is that there may still be a little piece of extracellular Friesold 1 which might be involved in this endocytosis. Okay, but the thing I want to point out as well is that we really have its complexity of dealing with those systems is that we're trying to infer mechanism based on three or four different proteins that we know about, and there may still be a lot of others that we haven't been able to find yet. So at least this may suggest that there is something else going on, at least for the endocytosis. But again, the Shibiri experiment is critical to demonstrate that you need that those dots are endocytotic dots. Okay, but one other thing we do detect if we remove the Friesold and Friesold 2 is that we do see an increase in extracellular accumulation of windlass. So this is again, this is doing a windlass extracellular staining in an imaginal disk where this is the red part here are the cells where we have removed the two Friesold receptors, and the green one are wild type, and you can see this increased. So you do need somehow those Friesold 2 receptors for windlass degradation.
So the vaguely visible stripe in the center.
That's windlass.
That's where windlass is being made.
Yeah.
and you still get wingless out, moving away from that stripe a significant distance, because that's that green area where you're not having degradation.
This? Right? No.
No, no, no. That right, you know,
this.
That area. There,
this is a clone, yeah.
As far as 20 cells away from the wingless source.
Yes.
And yet you still have wingless there, so wingless is moving out even though you don't have
the receptor. Because we think that the receptor is preventing the degradation, either presumably because maybe it's not being degraded, it's not being endocytosed.
So it's moving, and you also still have vesicles. You have vesicles.
Yes.
And you're moving.
But it could just be that there isn't something else which is as well internalizing, and that's why there may be in fact two kinds of dots contain wingless, and that's the alternative model. And that really comes down to this issue raised at the beginning, that what are we looking at really in terms of what are those dots, and which pool of wingless should we be paying attention to? And maybe we should just look at the extracellular wingless and everything is simple. And now if we start looking at those dots, everything is going to be a bit complicated.
You get increased signaling outside of the clone, at the
boundary? Yeah, so I don't know if we haven't followed it with a reporter here, but just to show you an additional example of what happens now if you modulate, if you increase the level of threshold, for example. And here, what you see is that if you now overexpress threshold 2, right, you can see, we see two things, basically. The first thing that we see is that there is too much threshold 2 is going to lead you to an increase of wingless. So you also trap, just like the proteoglycan, you trap extracellular wingless, but you also now start to affect the movement of wingless outside, because now you have depleted presumably the pool of available wingless for movement, and now what you see is that we see a loss of those kind of dots outside the wingless expression domain, which would suggest that somehow, again, that if we overexpress threshold 2, we can get over-trapping and depletion outside the clone. But in this case, what's different from the proteoglycan is that this trapping of wingless now is associated with an hyperactivation of the signaling pathway. And we can see that, for example, here, if we make we produce more threshold 2, we get an expansion of senseless. So the pathway, those receptors, too much receptor is hyperactivating the pathway. And similarly here, that's sort of consistent. Now what we've done here is to overexpress threshold 2 at the wing margin, and we can trap more wingless, and now we are seeing the effect on the distal-less gradient, which is being reduced because again we have trapped. The idea is that we trap. If you overexpress the receptor, you trap wingless, so you hyperactivate the signaling right there, but now you are preventing the long-range movement. So putting all of this together, then what we think is going on, that we think that in the absence of the threshold 2 signaling, wingless is still able to move. And then if we remove those receptors, we can see an accumulation of extracellular wingless, again, perhaps because we are not getting pool of wingless is not being endocytosed, or maybe there is also alternative model about some kind of protease activity and so on. And then if we increase the level of threshold 2, we trap extracellular wingless, and since we are depleting the pool of wingless available for movement, we are also affecting long-range signaling. But the implication is that we think that the function of those receptors is not really to promote the movement of wingless, but basically it's affecting the shape of this diffusion of wingless. So it's basically shaping the morphogenic gradient. But again, in all those experiments, I think it's really critical to understand that the respective amount of either the proteoglycan or the threshold receptor is really has to be well coordinated to be able to give the proper long-range effect and movement. And in fact, one of the additional level of complexity in those studies is that if you now look at the expression, the transcriptional regulation of proteins like threshold 2 and DALI-like and so on, all of those are most of the, if it's all free, they're all primary target of the wind pathway as well. So it's like when we're getting down to, a pretty complex picture where we have a system which is very buffered to some extent. So every time you, that's where, again, I wanted to put those slides about the myth of the cave from the beginning, because when we're starting to manipulate the system by genetics, by either overexpressing or removing some gene functions, we're perturbing the system in a way that we don't really have the tools yet to analyze properly, because we don't really know how that's going to change the stoichiometry of all those receptors or co-receptors at the cell surface.
What about the time scales for the process? So presumably some adaptive mechanisms in the uptake of and then there are other or endocytosis of receptors, and then there's transcription and regulation.
But I think that's really key, that we need to look at those systems in a more real-time picture here and try to visualize the way the system is responding. And we need to develop markers which are allowing us to follow both the movement and as well the transcriptional response at the same time. And that's, I think, is the kind of tool that we are going to need for. Yeah.
To connect this to what Eric said this morning, if you think about this going on with a blow fly, where the cells have 9 times the surface area, do you have anything about whether the number of receptors per cell or per unit area of membrane needs to be accelerated?
I can't really answer that. I don't know. I mean, I'm not even sure what a per cell number really means, because a lot of those receptors are probably clustered in ways that we don't really understand yet. So even if you have, let's say, 10,000 molecules of receptor on a cell, it's going to make a big difference if you cluster it in...
Let me ask a little differently. If I just understood what you said so far, this windless gradient is going to go a certain number of micrometers from the cells that produce it. That's not going to be enough in the
blow fly. Yeah, I'm not sure. I don't know what kind. I mean, there are many ways you can modify the system to make maybe wingless extracellular more stable by reducing the level of some kind of eventual protease or something. That may allow you to make wingless move, you know, 50 cells further. I think the machine which is stabilizing basically which is regulating the level of the different things might be enough to allow you to increase the range of movement.
To address the first part of your question, in CDC2 mutant, when you decrease the number of cell division and the cells grow bigger, so you have basically the same size and the same pattern with bigger cells. So that means the wingless must migrate based on the size and not the distance, and not at all with the number of cells.
Yeah.
Do over-expressed wingless
happen? What was that?
Over-expressed wingless.
Where?
Anywhere you like. The
mountain. Well, I don't know if anyone has...
For example, like the DB garden, what happened?
I don't know if anyone has done the C96 Gal4 with a US wingless type experiment. Right. I mean, you can make little clones of wingless and you can see the effect on locally, but in terms of trying to increase the endogenous level of wingless,
the prediction would be if you overexpress wingless on the margin, you had a higher.
This may have nothing to, maybe actually no response whatsoever, because you know some of the feedback loops, like for example, Friesel-free. There is a Friesel-free supposed to act as a dominant negative Friesel. So if the system is buffered to some extent, you have plenty of space. I mean, I'm sure that if you make so much of it, you're going to to get exactly what you expect for a completely overexpression phenotype. But if the system is buffered, it may just be it may allow you to go from a 1 to 1.5 type variation.
Heterozygote, where there is only one copy,
everything
is fine.
Yeah. So, I mean, there are other reasons why this might be the case. But so, anyway, this is a little bit the way we like to look at this function here, is that basically that wingless is secreted in the extracellular space, and then it binds with those low affinity apparent surface proteoglycan, which are going to promote their planar movement. And again, this dissociation, reassociation of wingless to the low affinity apparent surface proteoglycan may lead to this movement. And so in this case, the proteoglycan may simply create some kind of an environment that promotes the movement of morphogens. And then, again, it's a subsequent activation of the Friesold receptor, which would lead to the pathway activation, which would lead, again, to some kind of graded response. But again, I think it's really important, and that's something I'm not sure we can really study this properly, is to analyze the level of receptor, co-receptor, the respective level of those molecules in the cell. Okay, so what are we doing here? Yes?
Question about plasma. When you downregulated galley light and saw that there was less wingless movement, did you look where the wingless had gone? And particularly wondering whether it left the epithelium or something like
that? We know that wingless is lost from the receiving cells. And actually, we have experiments I didn't show on using an enzyme called NOTAM, which is supposed to remove some of the sulfation site. It's competing with this sulfotransferase, sulfatless activity. So it's like having, I don't want to get into this, but basically it's like giving us a loss of glypican activity. And when we do this, we basically see the same, that there is wingless does not bind to the cells. And I'm not sure where it goes. We can't really monitor that.
So in your last sentence, you need very precise regulation. What do you mean by very?
Well, I'm going to change. I precise regulation. because I do believe that the systems are buffered to some extent. And that's, so maybe if you go from 1 to 1.5, the system may be able to correct itself. But if you go from 1 to tenfold, then you may have... I mean, you have to realize that when we do those overexpression experiments with the Gal4 system, we are really loading the cell with those components.
So do you think with tenfold
increase? Again, this is where the limitation are. We do not know how to calibrate those things.
But
we
have the brightness of your label.
Yeah, this could maybe... This is getting into some area of cell biology where we need some help. Because I'm not sure. I mean, eventually, that's what we would like to know. We'd like to know what is the per cell concentration of all those components. And I think maybe having some small molecules that you can label, which recognize cell specific components, is going to be the way to go eventually, where you can monitor in the same cell two different protein level very precisely.
Okay, but I would say if the cells can almost cope with tenfold upregulation. That's not very precise regulation.
Yeah. I would describe
that as being quite robust.
But I can't really, I mean, I said 10, but I really have no idea what if it's 2 or if it's 100. But that's definitely some of the issues we need to monitor. But the real question is whether or not those systems are going to be the best one to study this, because I think we have the basic phenomenon is... I think it's pretty good, but the question now is to really get down to do the very accurate cell biology, and you might be better off in a system which is simpler, where you have more where you can control the parameters in a more controlled way. Maybe that the biology is too complex here. Which actually is a good transition from my second part of my talk, which is all doing experiments in cell culture. What was that? Yeah. Yes.
How do you
it's probably just level again, because when we remove it, mm-hmm. right, we see a little bit of accumulation, but this is not comparable to. I mean, those stainings are a bit tricky to do. We're having it's they are not. We see more accumulation, but maybe it's like a 1 to 2 fold. It's moving by itself.
I like that.
I have to stay on track then. I have no idea how this is happening.
I love it.
But yeah, so let me let me move out to those simpler system here, which and I just wanted to I wasn't going to talk about this originally, but this morning listening to some of the questions that people are interested with, I saw the we are very interested in trying to understand networks and what I've added here this sentence, which is an approach to identify robust modules, and maybe at the end of my talk you can
tell me what a module is.
Yes, I probably will. But basically, the way we started, we got interested in devising this methodology is mostly at the outcome of the completion of the genome project, which identified basically, which about at least 14,000 or so predicted open reading frame. I have no idea. I have to talk fast. But for us, what we decided to do is to devise the methodology where we could basically identify the function. In a more systematic manner on cell-based assays. And what we decided to do was to use this RNA interference method, and there was an important paper in the field, which was a paper from Jack Dixon, that who showed that if you you add double-stranded RNAs on S2 cells, or Drosophila cells, you can get a loss-of-function phenotype. This is crazy. the method is basically, if you just generate a double-stranded RNA, which can be, in our case, there are a number of different RNAi methodology out there now, but what we use, and which is working very well for the fly cells, is to use a large double-stranded RNA, about like 500 nucleotides in length or so. And the idea is that those are being getting to the cells, and they become...
Getting to the cells?
Yes, just they seem to... It works very well. It gets in. We don't really know. That's actually an issue because in the mammalian cells, it's the process is a bit different. But those double-stranded RNAs get processed in smaller pieces of about 21 to 23 nucleotide in size, and through some process that I'm not going to do. Presumably, yeah. But we don't know about the mechanism in flies. And actually, this specific gene you're talking about, I don't remember the name, we know it does not exist in flies. So it's something we've done with Craig Hunter. But anyway, the idea is that those things eventually lead to the degradation of the corresponding mRNA. And so I just want to show you that the system is very efficient because we can. So what we've done here is to monitor the depletion of different proteins and following the addition of different double-stranded RNAs. But anyway, this is was at an early stage in the analysis where we just wanted to convince ourselves that there was no cross interference between the different depletion, and we made double-stranded RNAs against the different MAP kinase in flies, and they all seem to target the appropriate MAP kinase. But importantly as well, we get a very specific cellular phenotype by depleting specific, in this case, GTPases, for example. So those are the S2 cells, S2R, which are stained with DNA, microtubule, and actin stain. And if we perturb the raw GTPase, we get cytokinesis defect. And you can see actually the efficiency of the RNAi effect. It's all the cells have those multinucleated phenotype. Then another type of GTPase, like CDC42, which would affect the corticolactin organization. Another one, RAB, would affect the overall shape of the cells. So we did the strategy we developed was to basically conduct screens in 384 well plates, which would allow us to screen the full genome in a matter of days. And the methodology, the way we have it now, is that we've synthesized double-stranded RNAs against 21,300 open reading frame. And we have those double-stranded RNAs stored in 96 well plates. And when we want to do a screen, a specific RNAi screen, we re-aliquot those 96 into 384. So we have about 58 plates for the one full genome. And then we add the Drosophila cells, which are specific readouts. And we simply base the cells in the RNA, and if we are using a luciferase plate reader, I say after 3 or 4 days of incubation, we can basically read the plates. So everything from, since now we have these, those reagents available, the entire screen only takes like 5 days. So if you have a good cell-based screen, you can get all the genes which respond in this methodology to the to read their effect in the assay that you're looking at. And in addition, we have we also have automated microscopy approach, which allows us to take images of all the whales if we want to study a cellular process. So just want to show the way we generated the double-strand RNA was as a result of collaboration with Renato Paro's group, which had generated about 22,000 or so gene-specific primers for microarray purpose. And what we did is to reattach, they had, I'm not really going to get into this time constraint, but we basically reattached T7 to those PCR products and conducted an in vitro transcription against for the 22,000 or so double-strand RNAs. And all the all the synthesis, all the quality of the synthesis has been is cataloged on our database. But basically now we have enough reagents to do a few hundred full genome RNAi screens. And just want to show you that those screens work actually very well. It's, this is a simple screen here where we're trying to identify all the genes in the couple of different cell lines which affect cell proliferation and or cell death. We're basically monitoring the number of cells per whale. And the way we do this is after incubating with the double-strand RNA, we lyse the cells and add luciferase and measure activity because the level of luciferase basically read the level of ATP, which is proportional to the number of cells. So what you see is that you actually have a linear relationship between the number of the activity of luciferase and the number of cells. So the idea then is to find all the double-strand RNAs which reduce the number of cells. And then as a control, we use this anti-apoptotic protein thread, which basically kills cells when it's not there. And you can see that you get a very strong reduction in the luciferase activity. And actually, when you take a picture of the whales, you see that there's no more cells there. So we've done this kind of screen, and this is the way the data actually looks like. And this is a composite of two full genome screens, screens done in duplicate in the KC cells. And the black dots mean that there are basically no cells in the well. And so you can see that from one screen to the other, the quantitative readout that we get is actually very good. We do believe that we have to do those screens in duplicate, because sometimes we have a little robotic mistakes where the cells are not being delivered. But in these screens, we found about 500 or so genes which have very significant effect on the number of cells, and they fall into different categories, and many of them are actually not known. There is nothing known about the annotation.
How many of those to get more cells?
This is a little bit more complex to determine, actually, because we don't leave the RNA long enough to see a significant proliferation. Because those cells turn around in, really depends on different media, but maybe 40 hours or so. So, but we can design additional screens just to have to pick those genes up, actually.
So, how does that number, 60% of all hits, has no functional? Hits are things that give you
less cells.
Less cells. And is that, if you were to just take all the putative open reading frames from the genome project.
Yeah.
Without having done this experiment, would 60% have no functional annotation?
The annotation is, so if you look at the real annotation, you only have about 10% of the fly genes which are annotated properly. About 20% of the open reading frames, there is some kind of annotation, but sometimes it's useless annotation. So I would say we only have some kind of information on about 10% of the genome.
So my question is basically, is this 60% characteristic of the population of the starting population, you know, of what we know about fly genome now? Is 60% of open reading frames have annotated function, or if 90% have annotated function, but only 60%.
No, yeah, so what I was saying that they are...
And you're enriching for things that don't have annotated functions.
No, only 20% of the genes have some annotations. So it just means that...
40%
right.
So you're...
Yeah. We're finding many new components, right? So the way we are actually, so we've developed a number of different tools to look at this information, and one of the things we're doing is to use like microarray type algorithm to look at the information. And for example, this what we're looking at are different specific double-stranded RNAs. So like this double-stranded RNA is killing, so in this colorimetric representation, red means basically no cells and green, normal number of cells. And so this double-stranded RNA would kill the KCs and the S2R, but this one has no effect, and, but it does affect the S2R cells quite significantly. So anyway, this kind of representation now allows us to go back and group genes which have very similar type of profiles eventually in some kind of functional groups. And for example, here, if we look at all the ribosomal protein, they pretty much have a very similar type of readout on this luciferase assay. Okay. So that's one type of screens we can do very quickly, which are those luciferase screens, but we can also do more microscopy-based screens where we look at the morphology. And it's basically the same strategy, except now we use an automated microscope to capture images of each of the whales. And then we can use different type of automated or non-automated analysis to evaluate the information. And so we've done a screen, which is a number of double-stranded RNAs trying to annotate for phenotypes, which affect where we can really look at like shape, cytoskeletal organization, mitosis, cytokinesis, cell death, and so on. We're using this triple stain and for actin, tubulin, and DNA. And I just want to show that now we can now go back and try to, we can annotate those phenotypes and do start building those phenoclusters or based on the similarity in phenotypes. So those colors, for example, represent different annotations where we found basically, in this case, four different genes which have a specific, which have the same kind of cellular phenotypes. And when we look at what happened, what we find eventually in those classes, it's start to make sense. And like in this case, we found, for example, the raw GTPase, and then we had the exchange factor table. And we found two different kinases, cyclin kinase, cytokine kinase, which are very similar phenotypes. In this kind of bizarre cellular shape phenotype, we got many of the components of the MAP kinase pathway. So the idea is really that to use this information, the different annotation of phenotypes, or phenoclustering to start building pathways using RNAi. And one of the really important aspects, I think, of the those RNAi screens that we can actually do suppressor genetics the same way we've been able to do it in the people have done in the field for many years. And I just want to illustrate this, where basically we can generate a specific phenotype using one double-stranded RNA and then screen it against the collection of double-stranded RNA that we have to pick up all the genes that would act as suppressors or enhancers of the initial phenotype. So in this case, here, we've looked at that if we knock out P10, which is a lipid phosphatase in the KC cells, the cells go from circular to bipolar. And we can...
Really? Sorry, did you say that again? Maybe from circular to bipolar?
Yeah, they take those kind of long, elongated shape. And, and P10, as you know, is a lipid phosphatase which acts by antagonizing the activity of the PI3 kinase and works through the AKT kinase. So we expect to actually find as a suppressor of this P10 phenotype, we should pick up suppressors like which are in those molecules. And in fact, if we now add P10 double-stranded RNA plus and other double-stranded RNAs, and we find that in that collection of suppressors would be the PI3 kinase can be identified. So I think this is quite powerful because now we can start really devising assays where we're gaining an activity, for example, and now whether or not it's a transcriptional activity or a cellular phenotypic phenotype, phenotypic feature, and then look for suppressors of those. But one thing that we are trying to do now is to, for example, this this change in shape that we induce with P10.
It's in culture,
so. Yes, yes. Yeah. So if the change in shape that we see, for example, using the P10 double-stranded RNA, we can also elicit the same kind of terminal shape change by using ecdysone, for example, something which has been known for quite some time. Yeah. Oh, I selected the what I showed you. Yeah.
I mean, what is your estimate really of the amount of knocking down?
Yeah, I. You know, I'm not going to have time to. Maybe it's very good. Let's put it this way. It's. I don't really have time to get into all of this. I mean, we've done very careful analysis, for example, for the cell cycle genes, where we can show that we're basically picking up almost everything that we expect in some specific assays. So it's they're working very well, and we're really not too worried about this efficiency of knocking down things and in terms of level. And that's why I was showing you a few of the blots where in the cases where we have followed the protein, the depletion, it works quite well.
But you're saying the efficiency is sort of a constant
It depends how you do the screen, because it's really a compromise in terms of how many days you want to start looking at your readout versus. So, for example, if the way we do the screens, we do them after 3 or 4 days of incubation, and that's if you read the information after 1 day, then you do have this problem of depletion, because most of the proteins are stable after that. But at 3 or 4 days, we found that this is usually the window where we can pick up most of the genes in the effect, the thing that we're looking at. But it's true that for some other assays where some proteins are maybe a little bit more resistant, maybe more stable, and you may have to wait 1 week or something. So in practice, it's good probably to do a couple of different time points, but I think the really is going to come down to when we do a full genome screen for one readout where we know we should pick up 20 of the components, if we're actually picking up 20 or 18 of them. And that's when we get, that's probably the number you'd like to hear about. But I can tell you for the cell cycle, we picked up almost 90% of the things that we were looking for.
And how much further are you going to get?
8 minutes. Okay, so the point here is that I really want to get down to the. So what I was trying to show you is that you have you can devise like in this case we are able to get two different or a very similar type cellular phenotype as a result of two different modifications of those cells, and the cellular phenotypes we are dealing with are probably. To some extent, there is less of a diversity than some of the phenotypes you may find in vivo. So when we'll be doing a screen for those kind of phenotypes, we expect to actually find more genes than what we would like to at the end. And so the way we are planning on resolving some of this is to basically generate different assays which are complementary to some extent, where you basically study the related process by using different type of stimulation. Like, so what we've done here is basically conduct a suppressor screen for the P10 double-stranded RNA and the ecdysone, and then see which one appear to be specific of one screen versus the other. And what we find is that, for example, here in yellow, since I don't have much time, I'm not going to go too much in details, but in yellow, what we find, so in white would be the double-stranded RNAs that we find which can suppress both the ecdysone and the P10 transformation. But in yellow are the ones which are only specific of the P10 suppression. And what's interesting is that we do pick up like PI3 kinase and AKT only in the P10 suppressor screen. So the idea is really to start building now screens which are complementary to try to really get down to the more specific genes involved in specific pathways. And so our goal now is to basically conduct, our long-term goal is, and let's really get down to this issue of networks and trying to find those modules that we talked about, is to be able to assign, is to basically do as many essays as we can over the next couple of years, and in different cell types to increase the diversity of repertoire of genes that we are targeting, and basically try to assign for all the genes in the fly genes is to assign them with some RNAi signature, and then subsequently use a phenoclustering type approach to basically build those relationships between groups of genes. And the idea then after that is to use this, I'm going to pass on this, but I can discuss that later if anyone's interested in terms of all the type of essays that we have developed and that we are also developing now. But the idea eventually is to build, so I'm going to skip on all the database issue, but is to integrate the screen, the results from the high throughput screens with information from other kind of genomic approach like microarrays or protein-protein interaction to try to navigate between the set of database and try to build a very strong relationship between groups of genes and eventually go back and try to assimilate, to generate hypotheses on some of the structure of some of those modules. So I guess I'm going to just want to show this one actually. I think this is, in terms of understanding the structure of those modules, is just wanted to show the data how you can actually combine microarrays and RNAi as a way to find precisely the relationship between some of the components involved in a signal transduction pathway. And basically, if you add in this example here, if you add LPS on fly cells, you basically have a number of genes that come up. And we can show that, so what we do is we do a profile here of where we knock out the TAC kinase, which is downstream of the LPS receptor. And what you see that if you knock out TAC, all the genes which were responding now are gone. But now, as we were doing that using more downstream components, we found that the pathway actually split on downstream of TAC. And then you have one branch of the pathway is a June kinase pathway, while the other one is the IKK, Kenny, Reddish pathway. And this is very clear because if you now knock out Kenny, you basically lose the induction of those genes, but those are not affected. And reciprocally, if you knock down EP or the GNK pathway, you get exactly the opposite profile. So those kind of RNAi approach in combination with microarrays, in terms of taking apart some of those modules, is going to be very powerful in terms of. I was going to just briefly say a word about the protein interaction networks, and that there is now information on about something like 23,000 protein-protein interactions, which are going to become available at some point from Curagen. And the idea then is that if you are able to if you have a database of information for protein-protein interactions and RNAi cell-based assays, you may find that you identify some new components in the some Wnt, for example, in this case, a type of reporter assay, and you may be able to then directly go to those dictionary of protein-protein interaction and really build information that really tells you that those interactions might be real. This actually is the way those database of protein-protein interaction looks like. You have, for example, that the beta-catenin protein binds to something like seven or other proteins, which all of them also bind to others. So the idea is really to navigate from those databases to take apart some of those conserved modules. And I'm going to stop here.
Thank you very much.
What I suggest we do is that what we'll do is we'll come back at 4 o'clock. And then we're going to have more gradients. And then I think I'd still like you in the general discussion to talk about what you mean by a module.
Okay.
But there are a lot of interactions in there. So let's go and have...
Well, I can answer that right away. I mean, a module to me would be two proteins, for example, like RAF and MAP kinase, kinase, kinase. where the two proteins in all the essays, which have been functional essays that people have looked into, are behaving exactly similarly.
For you, a module would be an enzyme and a substrate.
Yeah, something where there is a... well, but then you can amplify it to a cascade if there is more interaction.
Thank you very much indeed. Let's go and have a break now for half an hour. Back at 4 o'clock, please, for gradients. This time, decapental teaching.